1754, Dineta Cole versus State of Illinois. Mr. Baker. Exquisite timing, I might say, that your client worked in an office that's been in the news quite a bit the last few years.
Yes, she did. Thank you, and may it please the court, good morning. My name is John Baker. I am here today asking this court to review a grant of summary judgment issued by the district court. This case is an FMLA retaliation claim. And I first would like to address one of the issues that has been brought up in the subsequent briefing before this court and also by Mr. Elitz in some of his supplemental submissions to the court. The question is, what type of action is actionable, I suppose, under the FMLA's anti-retaliation rules? Mr. Elitz suggests that there must be some type of a materially adverse action. And he gets that from the traditional language that had been used in the substantive Title VII claims. In this court's case in Washington and then in the Burlington Northern case in the Supreme Court, the issue of the distinction between retaliation language under Title VII and the substantive provisions of Title VII was addressed. That language is different. But we can't simply take the anti-retaliation language of Title VII and apply it to an FMLA claim. The language itself is different. The FMLA anti-retaliation language comes specifically from the rules promulgated by the United States Department of Labor. And what it says is employers cannot use the taking of FMLA leave as a negative factor in employment actions such as disciplinary actions. There's no language in there about materiality. This is not a question where this court has to try and understand what was meant by that language. The language is very, very clear.
Well, it doesn't make sense, though, does it, that you would require some material adverse effect on somebody's job situation that relates to FMLA leave?
Well, I'm not so sure.
You're not going to argue that just any trivial thing would trigger.
Well, no. But what I'm referencing is discipline, and in this case, we do have discipline. That they have said that it is inappropriate to use FMLA in the consideration of discipline. That's different language than what is used in the anti-retaliation provisions of Title VII.
This is a case, isn't it? Some sort of an employee improvement plan or something.
Our position is, ultimately Ms. Cole was terminated because of this performance improvement plan. We maintain that both the termination and the performance improvement plan are actionable under the anti-retaliation provisions. Now, the defendants, the people who made the decision, both testified that this was in fact discipline. They testified it was discipline. Now, Judge Edmonds, I want to address a little bit about the facts of what happened. Ms. Cole had been in an automobile accident on November 10th. She returned to work from a FMLA leave at the request of her employer. She was told, look, your work is building up. We need you to come back. She went to her doctor, and she requested that she be allowed to come back. Her doctor, at the time she was taking a variety of different medications, her doctor said, you can go back part-time, which is, in fact, what she did. There were a couple of days after she returned where she was late to work. However, she had cleared that with her immediate supervisor before she returned to work. Ms. Cole had done nothing inappropriate during the time that she was off of work. The question in this case is there sufficient evidence from which a jury could conclude that her FMLA leave was a cause for her termination? Well, in this case, we believe that there are significant pieces of evidence which certainly could lead a jury to reach that conclusion. The performance improvement plan itself outlines her attendance and that this was problematic. There are documents, there are statements from her supervisor talking about her attendance being a problem. From my perspective, I understand that. Ms. Cole's medical leave had become an issue. It had become problematic. But in the context of FMLA, that's irrelevant. The fact remains that an employer cannot simply say, well, your FMLA is a hardship, therefore we're going to fire you.
No, the leave wasn't the problem. It was the work schedule when she was working part-time that was the problem, wasn't it?
Well, if you accept what they say, they maintain that there were two instances where she was not there at the time she was supposed to be there.
So what did this performance improvement plan suggest or require?
The performance improvement plan said a couple of things, but primarily it said she had to write out what her schedule was going to be for the week, and she had to provide them on a daily basis of what her schedule was going to be. That's what it outlined.
Mm-hmm. She was expecting to work, right?
She was expecting to work. She had been working.
This is a part-time schedule that she was supposed to set out.
Her doctor, had authorized her to return to work to work 3 hours a day, and that's what she had done.
So this performance improvement plan was going to, I assume, set out how and when she's going to operate in this 3-hour days.
Correct.
And she wouldn't sign it.
Which had previously been outlined by her doctor. I mean, that is what the performance improvement plan on its face said to do. Donetta Cole objected to it because she thought it wasn't reasonable. The performance improvement plan also talked about reviewing her performance at the end of the term. So she exercised her rights under Governor Blagojevich's personnel policies to file a written grievance. And that is specifically provided for in the personnel policies. She did that. She presented it to her supervisor, as is also spelled out within the policies. She suggested something else. The policies state that if an employee and their supervisor cannot reach a resolution on an issue, on a grievance, it is to go directly to Chief of Staff John Harris. If it can't be resolved by him, it's supposed to go to Governor Blagojevich. So in this case, Donetta Cole did exactly what is suggested to her in the personnel policy. She said, I don't like this. I don't think it's fair, which is a grievance. She filed that with her supervisor, exactly what she was supposed to do. Instead of it going to the chief of staff, instead of it going to the governor, she was fired. So she complied exactly with what she was supposed to do.
Well, you're saying she didn't, didn't follow a personnel policy.
Well, she followed the personnel policy.
But you're saying that her employer did.
Her employer did not.
Well, that's a different gripe, isn't it?
Well, no. I think it all goes to a question of what's the true motivation for her termination. And, you know, this court in the past has said that when employers do not follow their policies and their procedures, a jury can, of course not mandated to, but can infer that that is discriminatory. And that's really what we're getting at here. You know, they had these policies and procedures set up. The question here is, why was she terminated? All we are saying is, this is an issue for a jury to decide, not for a court on a cold record. This is an issue for a jury. There are inferences, Judge Mannion, that can be drawn both ways on that. But those are inferences that need to be resolved by a jury and not by a court. That's the fundamental point of our argument. And I think that when we look at the factors here, when we look at the evidence, it becomes fairly clear that this is a question of why was she fired? That's it. Why was she fired? There's evidence here. A jury could find it was for FMLA in retaliation for that. We are asking that this court allow a jury to resolve that question and not a judge. But I see I've entered my rebuttal, and unless there are any more questions, I'll reserve. Thank you.
Mr. Ellis.
Good morning, Your Honors. Illinois Assistant Attorney General Carl Elitz for the defendants. Mr. Baker, may it please the Court. Your Honors, there are two separate reasons why summary judgment was properly granted in this case. The first was that the performance improvement plan that was given to Ms. Cole was not a materially adverse action sufficient to make out a claim under the FMLA. The second is that there are no facts here from which a jury could reasonably infer that FMLA animus was a factor in the decision to give her the performance improvement plan. Now, Your Honors, Mr. Baker's correct. I do have my first issue, I think, is the cleanest and quickest way to resolve this case, and it's my position that the performance improvement plan must be a materially adverse action. I based that analysis on the Supreme Court's decision in Burlington Northern. I disagree with my opponent, however, with regards to his discussion of what is substantive and what is not substantive about that analysis. In the Burlington Northern case, there were two sections of Title VII at issue. One was 703 and one was 704. 703 was the anti-discrimination provisions that prohibited employers from discriminating on terms and conditions of employment. 704 was the anti-retaliation provisions. In Section 704, the Supreme Court analyzed the language, the anti-retaliation provisions, and noted the language discriminate against, and then proceeded to find that this language suggested to them that Congress intended that there be some materiality in an employee's claim that they've been retaliated against. So in Burlington Northern, in the retaliation discussion, the court found there was a materiality requirement. It's the same thing in FMLA. Mr. Baker's brief sets out the language of the Department of Labor regulation he's using to bring his retaliation claim. It also uses the words discriminated against. And so a fair inference is that under the FMLA, there's the same requirements as there is under Title VII. That is, that there must be some material action by the employer, not just any action. Now, the Seventh Circuit has said this specifically, requiring material adverse action in FMLA cases in two 2008 cases, and I've cited those in my 28J letter. It's my suggestion that this performance improvement plan that she received was not a materially adverse action because it didn't do anything that would deter a reasonable employee from seeking FMLA benefits, which is the test. It only required that she communicate with her supervisors as to when she would be out of the office, and that's deviating from her part-time schedule that she had been given. She was asked to watch her tone when dealing with constituents because there was a record of her not being appropriate in her tone with her constituents and also other members of the staff. And also the last thing the performance improvement plan did was ask her to be efficient, particularly in her filing duties. None of these things would deter a reasonable employee who wanted to do a good job from seeking FMLA benefits. It simply asked her to do the job that she was expected to do. Now, Mr. Baker says that this was a form of discipline, and I can't disagree that in the minds of my clients this was a type of discipline, but it is the very lowest type of discipline. A performance improvement plan is simply designed to bring to an employee's attention a problem with prior conduct and to request that she do something to resolve that. So as discipline go, this is a very, very low level of discipline, and I would suggest it's not the type of discipline the Supreme Court had in mind when it set up the materially adverse action requirement. There are several other circuits that have specifically considered performance improvement plans. They're cited in my brief. In each of those cases, the court concluded that the performance improvement plan there was not an adverse employment action. That's a little different than materially adverse action, but I would suggest that if it's not an adverse action in those cases, it's not likely to be a materially adverse action, assuming that our plan is no more onerous, and I think there's no suggestion that the plan at issue right now is onerous in any way. As I said, it's a very simple requirement that she simply show up for work, tell her employers when she's going to be absent, and moderate her tone and be efficient in her duties.
Now, she didn't sign it, so and that causes her termination.
Yes, and Your Honor, one of the things that Mr. Baker said was that he was complaining about two different actions here. One was the giving her the performance improvement plan, and the other was terminating her. I don't think they can bring a termination as an adverse action because she wasn't terminated. The plan itself gave her three business weeks, 15 days, before they would meet again to make a decision as to what they would do going forward. And even then, it wasn't clear that they would terminate her. If she did what was required of her under the plan, she would obviously not be terminated, and the performance improvement plan would be successfully resolved. So they can't claim that her termination was an adverse action. They can claim that the giving her the plan was an adverse action, but I don't think this plan supports that.
Well, the plan, okay, she gives her the plan, and well, how long did it take her to decide not to sign it?
I believe she took an extra week or so, Your Honor.
So she hung off that for a week and then came back and said, I'm not going to sign it?
She gave them a counterproposal, refused to sign the plan that they had offered her, and she then left.
So she left, or what? Went away for further. Was she terminated at that point?
Yes, on December 28th.
So that, I guess you'd call that an intervening cause or something anyway, but at least separates it from the FMLA.
I think so, yes. I mean, I think she was terminated because she refused to sign the performance improvement plan. I suppose that's a type of insubordination. And there's no connection of that to any sort of animus towards the FMLA. There's no argument by Mr. Baker that his client received anything less than everything under the FMLA she was entitled to receive. There's no claim that she wasn't given the time off. She received 3 full weeks off after the accident, and then was given a part-time schedule once her doctor certified her as capable of coming back part-time. I want to touch on the second argument, which I think is an independent ground, and the court doesn't need to get there in my view, but if the court does get there and determines that there is a materially adverse action here, I don't believe there's a fair inference to be drawn from the facts that Ms. Cole was terminated because of the FMLA animus that she alleges. She had co-worker problems beginning in January of 2005. She did receive a positive performance in review in March, but both supervisors, Ms. Montgomery and Ms. Brown, said that they were receiving complaints from co-workers. A critical incident occurred in May of 2005, long before her accident, when she refused to shred a piece of campaign mail that had been misdirected to the correspondence office. She says she was at that point demoted. She says she was again demoted 2 weeks later. This is from her deposition testimony. So there were problems in that regard. At one point, she was told to sit by the door and told by her supervisor that she was sitting at the door because she was one step from being out the door. Now, I don't understand how an argument can be made that she was a good employee doing her job and then the FMLA leave issue came up and then she was terminated. If he had those facts, that would suggest an inference to a jury possibly that it was the FMLA that caused the performance improvement plan. But given the fact that there was a long history here, including constituent complaints, which she acknowledges at least 2 of them in her deposition testimony, co-workers were not speaking to her after May of 2005. She says that she baked goods and brought them to the office to try to resolve things more amicably, and it was unsuccessful. So it was a very tense work environment at the time that she had her accident. When she came back, they saw the same sort of problems and provided her with a performance improvement plan, which, again, I think is very, very light discipline, if you can even consider it that. It was simply a written notice to her saying, we have problems with some of your conduct. If you correct them, we can go forward. And she refused to sign that. So for both of those reasons, because the plaintiff doesn't have a materially adverse action, and because it's not a fair inference on these facts to suggest that she was terminated because of the anti-FMLA animus they allege, I would argue that summary judgment was properly granted. And
so
the court
this plan was then intended to extend beyond the time of, part-time. It's supposed to go beyond that time as well. The part-time when she's recovering and long-term.
My reading of the record, Your Honor, is that they expected that her part-time status would soon end. Her doctor had said that she would be back in December of 2005, and by now we're in mid-December. I do think there's also an inference that her health was not very good at that time. So it's possible that they knew this was going to go on longer or not. But the plan was very specific and said, with regard to the hours you're scheduled to work, we expect you to be here to keep your personal issues out of the office during those times and to let us know in writing, both of the supervisors, because there was an ongoing problem where Ms. Cole suggested that she had told one supervisor she would be out and the other would become upset with her because he didn't understand this. The plan resolves this by saying, from now on, when you're not going to be here, tell both of us in writing. Because there was also a fight in just before the performance improvement plan was given where there was some back and forth where they accused her of not telling them and she insisted that she had. So that's what that part of the plan was all about. My time is up. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Baker.
Thank you. I know my time is short. I'll be very brief. A couple of quick points, though. Number one, the suggestion that she was not fired, I really don't know where that comes from. In our appendix, on page 70 of our appendix, which is page 68 of Jay Brown's deposition testimony, he says, she, you know, did not want to sign the document and go along with the plan, and she was terminated. So she was terminated. I mean, the suggestion that she just walked out and there was no resolution is completely inaccurate. Second of all, Judge Mannion, I think it was you who were asking questions about the timing. She was presented this performance improvement plan on December 22nd. She had a meeting with them where she presented her response on December 28th. So there wasn't some 15-day period of time. There were only a couple of days, and during that period of time, you had a weekend and you had the Christmas and New Year and Christmas Eve holidays. So there was not a long time that had passed between when she was given the plan and when she was fired.
Well, she had been back a while from her leave.
She returned, I believe, and it's clear in the record, but I believe it was December 5th when she came back to part-time status.
So this between the 5th and the 22nd, she's got some kind of a work record of part-time, I guess.
She was part-time, but the problem is there were no problems. You know, they contend that there were all these problems in her work performance. They never could identify them. They say in generalities there are problems, there are morale problems, constituents are complaining. Who? What constituents complained? What did they say? They've never presented that evidence. They're relying on generic information, generic statements, when they don't have any evidence to show what it is that they have done. This is not fair. She deserves a jury trial to allow a jury to resolve these questions. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Both counsel, the case will be taken under advisement.